I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Businesses, big and small, are around to make money, and the more money, the better. But does that pursuit of financial gain and the bottom dollar preclude an organization from doing the right thing? Today we'll talk to former Sprint CEO Dan Hesse about his work with Just Capital. He'll explain how companies can prioritize their employees and customers while still making a profit. But first, the KC Symphony is teaming up with several local legends to pay tribute to Kansas City Jazz. A couple of those local legends will join us in studio to talk about this weekend's lineup and about the history of symphonic jazz. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Well, Charlie Parker did it, so why not Bobby Watson and Deborah Brown? We're talking about mixing jazz with strings or even a full orchestra. That's what will take place this weekend as Bobby and Deborah combine with other KC jazz greats, including David Bassey, to present a celebration of our homegrown music with the Kansas City Symphony. Charlie Parker, of course, is a Kansas City native credited with inventing bebop and modern jazz. Here to talk about what's coming up beginning on Friday night are the legendary Bobby Watson, who wrote the theme music to Up to Date. He's a member of the American Jazz Museum's Walk of Fame at 18th and Vine. Bobby, always great to have you here. Welcome back.
Thank you, Steve. Great to be back.
The great singer Deborah Brown is also here. She sings all over the world and was just on our show last week, and I'm glad you're not tired of us yet, Deborah.
Nope, never. Thanks, Steve.
And here to offer some historical context is Chuck Haddix. He's host of the Fish Fry here at KCUR, and he's director of the Mar Sound Archives. He's taking part in this project as well. And Chuck, always good to have you.
Always good sitting in with you, Steve.
Bobby, how tricky is it to play with a full symphony behind you?
It's not going to have the momentum of a small group.
Right.
And the time feel is more steady.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in a small group, sometimes it rushes, sometimes it slows down. It just, you know, even though it doesn't change drastically, but there's ebbs mm-hmm. and flows. But you know, with the rhythm section you're going to have this Friday and Saturday, it should be a lot of fun. You know,
is it more restrictive to a free form player like you?
In a way, in the fact that you don't have as much time to develop.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to tailor your improvisations around the arrangements, which is a lot of fun now.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like it's a drag, you know. It's just another way of playing, you
mm-hmm.
know. And it's beautiful to play within orchestrations.
Deborah Brown, what's the toughest part of playing with a full symphony behind you?
Well, I'm making sure you don't forget where to come in. I don't know.
Because if you do,
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Now, where was I?
Yeah. Yeah. What happens then,
so you gotta
right?
You got to know your stuff.
Yeah. Does a gig like this bring out the butterflies?
Every gig brings out the butterflies.
Well, okay.
That's true.
But a full symphony behind you, does that add some level of pressure?
Well, actually, it's so exciting, and it's so beautiful. I'm just looking forward to the experience.
Yeah.
It's a different experience than having three musicians behind you, and then now you have a full orchestra. Oh, yeah. And it's like riding a Cadillac or
really?
Like Rolls Royce. Yeah.
Bobby, do you have to get those classically trained musicians to loosen up a little bit?
I would say that's a... Generally, but you know the musicians in the Kansas City Symphony, this is their pops orchestra,
right?
So I mean, Keith, a couple of my colleagues that are going to be there, and in the orchestra. Mm-hmm. So and they, you know, they have sensibilities, mm-hmm. and I think the people that are in the Pops Orchestra volunteer for this. I mean, they want to do it, so mm-hmm. they have another sensibility. And if that, you know, instead of playing Mahler or something,
right.
these are the ones, the hip ones, and so called, you know, hip ones that are in the orchestra that like doing these type of things.
Yeah. You know, Chuck Haddock, some might wonder about the pairing of jazz with an orchestra. Does it make sense to you?
Sure it does. You know, Charlie Parker was a student of classical music.
Uh-huh.
He was known to pore over scores by Stravinsky mm-hmm. when he was on the road with the Earl Father Hines band. And he often quoted classical pieces. And he loved the string recordings. Were his most successful recordings. They sold a lot. But you notice, he sounds very different because he's playing the melody straight because mm-hmm. he's playing with strings.
Mm-hmm. And are you surprised that those albums sold more than other albums?
Not really. They're very accessible. You know, I mean, they're very lush. It's a different sound for Bird. But ironically, it cost him his, when he was played with strings, it cost him his regular band because the regular band members were not part of that group.
Wow.
Unlike Bobby, who's using his rhythm section. Mm-hmm. Bird didn't use his rhythm section with the strings. And so Red Rodney and the other musicians just drifted off because they couldn't find any work. So this forced him to go out on the road as a single, and he would play with local pickup groups that were really not on par with him musically.
Yeah. Well, where's my thinking wrong? Because I always think of jazz as street music, and I think of an orchestra as the music of these big, elaborate halls, and, you know, it's a different thing altogether.
Well, you know, when Bird went to Lincoln, he played with the symphony there, too, the orchestra there, as well as the concert band.
Lincoln High School?
Lincoln High School, yeah.
Really?
He played with both bands. So he was no stranger to classical music, and there's a system of education which Bobby is carrying on where these are trained musicians that were coming up. And they knew they could play classical as well as jazz, but most classical musicians can't play jazz as well as classical. That's the irony
that's
there.
Right. So, Bobby, it makes sense to you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah. I started on the clarinet, and I did Mozart and the Weber concertos for clarinet and stuff like that, and I've done some classical saxophone pieces mm-hmm. while I was in college, and I always have listened to classical music. I love Bartok. You know, mm-hmm. I like Wagner, you know, for certain things.
And this isn't the first time you've done this with the symphony, right?
No, it's not. I enjoy it. It's a high point for me. I mean, it sort of, in a way, validates our study and our training that we've done, that we're able to come together mm-hmm. and take advantage of this beautiful landscape that's going to be behind us.
Mm-hmm. Deborah, you're nodding your head. You agree with that?
I agree with that.
Yeah. It's
because
all
that's
good.
That's when I went to the university. There was no jazz there. I think we had three musicians where you're teaching. We had three musicians there that were quote jazz musicians, and we didn't know what to make of that. But everyone had to study classical music. I was studying classical music myself. The music that we're performing is music that I did on the in the North Netherlands Orchestra. We did a special program there with the orchestra there. So these charts are from that.
You're just
program.
Bringing it right back over here,
yep,
then.
That's
yeah.
it. Yeah.
I was going to say a lot of jazz giants have done this. I mentioned Charlie Parker, Clifford Brown did it, Stan Getz. Let's take a listen to the man credited with inventing modern jazz again, Kansas City's own Charlie Parker. This is Jess Friends from the album Charlie Parker with Strings. Thank you. Chuck, this is a highly regarded album, this Charlie Parker with strings. Tell us a little more about it.
Well, he recorded this in the mid-1950s, and he had been to Europe, and Marcel Mule was his favorite saxophonist, a classical saxophonist. And Norman Granz, when Bird signed to Verve Records, Norman Granz took control of his career. Mm-hmm. And Bird always wanted to record with an orchestra, so they put together this string section, and which included actually Mitch Miller on oboe.
Really?
Yeah, and these are all classically trained. And then they made these recordings, and they just took off. Some in Downbeat kind of panned him because he was playing the melody straight, but they were very commercially very successful and brought him some financial comfort at a time when he really needed it.
Yeah, jazz musicians always need it.
Yeah, it was not necessarily a real harmonious relationship all the time. At one point when he was playing Birdland, he got mad and fired the whole string section.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I think he was banned from Birdland as a result from the bad behavior that night.
You know, Bobby, there's always that story about Charlie Parker that just fascinates me, this notion that for a long time in Kansas City, he wasn't that well regarded. And then at some point one summer, he goes down to the Ozarks and plays for a summer, and he comes back, and suddenly he's a completely different musician. People looking at him like, you know, who's this guy all of a sudden? You just wonder, what happened down there in the Ozarks? Did he, it's like Robert Johnson at the crossroads or something, you know?
Well, I'd have to defer to Chuck. Chuck has one of the, my favorite book on Bird, and you talked about that where he went away, and I think he was playing in resorts down there and had a lot of time on his hands, or Chuck?
Well, he was always experimenting with his horn.
Right.
Lawrence Keyes said it was raggedy as a pet monkey. And he would burn the cork and all this stuff. But he went to the Ozarks in 1936 for a gig at Musser's Ozarks Tavern Thanksgiving Day, and there was a wreck, and it broke his back and his ribs and killed George Wilkinson.
That's what got him started on.
Yeah, and he got a new horn out of that. And so the next summer, he went down there with Georgie Lee's band to Musser's Ozark Tavern, which was in about 5 miles south of Eldon, Missouri. Mm. And because they couldn't come home on the weekends, because those are all sundown communities there where African Americans did not want to get caught in a small town. So he stayed on site and he learned all the chord changes and practiced his saxophone all summer long. And when he was woodshedding. And when he came back, according to Gene Ramey, it was just night and day. He was just fully, there he was playing bebop and fully formed.
Wow. What, was this the first album that combined strings and jazz this way, or had it been done prior to Charlie Parker?
It really had not been done prior to Charlie Parker. And then immediately after Bird did this, then Dizzy started recording with strings, and everybody recorded with strings.
Yeah.
He kind of opened the door for that.
How do you regard this album, Bobby?
Well, if you call my cell phone, you will hear what just played.
Oh, is that right? Yeah.
Yeah, and it's been there for years, and I've been listening to this record since I was in high school. And this particular one, Just Friends, I'm going to take this off my bucket list because I'll be able to play it this weekend.
No,
I've been
kidding.
Always wanted to play that arrangement, and as time went on, the arrangements became available commercially, and so you can buy arrangements from the whole album. And we've picked two, this one, Just Friends, and another one.
No,
they can't
kidding.
Take that away from me. So I'm like a kid in a candy store. It's like dreaming of being in the Super Bowl since you were a kid, and you finally
made it.
Finally get to go to Disneyland.
I should point out a tribute to Kansas City Jazz from Basie to Bebop featuring Bobby Watson and Deborah Brown takes place this weekend. There's performances Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday afternoon at Kauffman Center, Helzberg Hall. For tickets, go to kcsymphony.org. Deborah, this is an album that you're pretty familiar with, too.
Yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. You have it and listen to it and know it?
Oh, yeah. I love Parker.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you have to love Parker if you're from around here, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Which jazz artist cut the greatest recording with strings? Is there one that, is this the one, or is there another one?
To me, that's the one.
That's the one.
That's the
definitive.
One.
Definitive.
That's
yeah.
the one.
Yep.
Yeah. Deborah, tell us about the concert coming up this weekend. I mean, who's performing? What can people expect?
Well, I think what's kind of remarkable is the fact that one of Bobby's former students, Herman Mahari.
Oh, sure.
He's going to be playing the trumpet.
Trumpet, yeah.
Yeah, and then we've got Victor Lewis on drums. We've got mm-hmm. we've got a great rhythm section from New York.
Yeah.
I mean, this is Curtis Lundy.
Oh, that's your old buddy.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
He's awesome.
Yeah.
So, and then, of course, with David and his, I mean, he's Mr. Jazz with the bebop, so he's going to be doing some things, but it's just going to be a remarkable weekend of music.
Yeah. Yes. Are you guys going to play around town at all besides this?
I don't know if we'll have time.
Yeah,
but Stephen Scott on piano as well as
kidding.
Rod Fleeman. And, you know, mm-hmm. Rod Fleeman and Curtis and myself, we went to school together down in Miami. So I don't think Rod has seen Curtis in several decades. So that's going to be a beautiful experience as well.
Hey, Chuck, what's your role with this whole thing?
I'm going to be conducting the pre-conference talk mm-hmm. and just kind of keeping things moving.
Yeah.
Mine is to hit, get, and split and get out of the way and let the music.
But hit, get, and split. Hey, there you go.
I was thinking about this program, though, but not only are we celebrating the traditions of Kansas City Jazz. We're celebrating Kansas City Jazz today because these musicians really are a culmination of the tradition. There's always been this tradition in Kansas City Jazz where older players would pass it on to younger players.
Right.
And Claude Williams called it the Kansas City stamp. Musicians from Kansas City, no matter where they'd go, another musician would say, "You're from Kansas City," mm-hmm. you know, as soon as they heard him play. And so this is Kansas City today as well as a celebration of Kansas City Jazz.
Which is the point of this whole celebration, right?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
I might humbly say that Rich DeRosa, who has done a lot of the arranging for the concert, he's doing a couple of arrangements of my original compositions, which I can't wait to hear.
Oh, no kidding.
Which is going to be beautiful to hear with strings and stuff. And my wife, Pam, she did a string arrangement of Love Remains, and it's to hear about, you know, three of my compositions exploded like this.
Yeah.
That's a real thrill as well.
Well, just curious, what's the next big project on your plate right now, Deborah? What's next for you?
Well, Bobby and I actually are going to go to Sweden. The mm-hmm. concert hall invited us there. They invited me to bring anyone I'd like, and I said, "Well, you know, we've got a fantastic rhythm section, and then we have Bobby Watson." And they said, "Oh, great, bring him." So I'm like, "Okay."
Put him in your suitcase, yeah.
So that's the same theater that they have the Nobel Peace Prize.
Yeah, right.
And then also just a week later, of course, right. Bobby's got to come back to Kansas City. But a week later, I've also been invited to bring some Kansas City musicians over to a festival in Poland.
Okay.
So Herman Mahari is mm-hmm. going to be over there with Christian Dominic Sanders.
Dominic, sure.
Mike Warren.
Oh, sure.
And piano player.
Charles?
No. I'm sorry.
Oh, he lives over there.
Ryan Lee was going to go, but he's got some conflicts.
Oh, okay.
And then we've got another great pianist that's going over.
Oh, okay.
How come you guys never take talk show hosts when you do these trips? What's wrong with you guys? You know, we I don't know what we would do, but we should do something. What's right. next for you, Bobby?
Like I said, Sweden, and then I'm going to come back home because I got teaching obligations, and then I'm going to go right back over and meet them in Poland. You know,
okay. That's right. Bobby's got his own night over at the Jazz Festival.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm going to stay over one extra night just so I can hang out afterwards with the party. They asked me to stay one extra day, so I'm going to stay extra day.
All right. A tribute to Kansas City Jazz from Basie to Bebop featuring Bobby Watson and Deborah Brown Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday afternoon at Helzberg Hall at the Kauffman Center. Go to kcsymphony.org to grab some tickets for that. And good luck. Have a great time at the...
Thank
at the
you.
Show this weekend.
We will
good luck,
do.
Guys.
Thank you.
Thank
Peter
you, Steve.
Peter Schlamm.
Sure.
Yeah, he's
okay.
Going.
Time for a break. When we come back, former Sprint CEO Dan Hesse will join us to talk about Just Companies. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, we learned about what makes our favorite TV theme songs unforgettable, and we talked with a local business owner reviving Kansas City's jazz scene. You can hear those conversations and other previous shows. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, we learn about the life of Laura Ingalls Wilder that goes beyond the writer's Little House stories. Also, with the Cleveland Indians retiring Chief Wahoo, we examine the use of Native American imagery in sports logos. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, companies exist to make money. We can all agree on that. But how they make that money matters to a lot of people, too. I'm talking about earning that money ethically and responsibly. A nonprofit research organization called Just Capital just released its list of America's 1,000 largest companies based on how just they are. That means looking at how they treat their workers, how much respect they show for their customers, product quality, and a whole lot more. Dan Hesse, the former CEO of Sprint, serves on the board of Just Capital, and he joins me here in the studio. And Dan, welcome back. Always good to have you here.
Hi, Steve. Great to be here.
Well, Just Capital has been around since 2013. What's it all about?
Well, I think you described kind of the mission of Just Capital. We went out and surveyed over 70,000 Americans and found that Americans, and by the way, this is one of the things the American people, both Democrats and Republicans, agree on.
For once.
For once, is that they believe capitalism can be a force for good, and they strongly support capitalism, but think it's been moving in the wrong direction over the last few years. And to oversimplify, it's because there's been so much focus, if you will, on only shareholders, and particularly, you know, shareholders in the short term versus other stakeholders that they think that the companies that they do business with, that they buy products from, they work for, that they invest in, should have a more positive, broader cause. And those other constituents being, as you mentioned, number one, and by the way, the surveys, what we wanted to do is also find out from the American people, how do you define just? What do you want to see? Because I might have, you know, different priorities than somebody else. But what Just went out and did is, based upon those criteria, we went out and got lots and lots of very hard data, you know, statistics, to rank companies from 1 to 1,000 based upon how just they are, based upon the criteria of the American people. So those criteria, and we kind of weighted the results, if you will, by those criteria, with how they treat employees being number one. I mean, that's what... and how they treat customers being number two. That's what they want. So Americans have said they'd pay, 84% said they would pay more for a product from a just company versus other companies. They'd work for a company for 79% for less pay. Huh. And that's who they want to invest in. So customers number one, employees number one, customers number two, high quality products. Not only, you know, are they high quality, but are they good for society? The environment, their environmental track record, what companies do for their communities, and shareholders. Shareholders are important, but they're not the most important stakeholder.
Do you think capitalism's heading in the wrong direction? Is that something, a belief that you share?
It is. And I think it's because of this incredible focus on just the short term, because there are a lot of decisions that you make. And I saw this as a CEO. That are long term in nature, and they're not going to have payoffs over the short term. I also believe that there are stakeholders beyond just shareholders. I also believe if you treat these other stakeholders well over the long term, if the company can be long term, it is in shareholder interests. Mm-hmm. But what's been missing in terms of information, and well over 90% of the American people said they just want this information, almost like a Consumer Reports. Mm-hmm. We don't know who the just companies are. And so I've always believed that if people knew what corporate behavior was like, had, if you will, a Consumer Reports for justness, that they would act on it. And they said they would. And that would align shareholder interests with the interest of all these other stakeholders. So if they're paying more money or buying products from these companies,
right,
if the right people, the best people, are going to work for these companies, and very importantly, if people are investing in the shares of these companies, then you get the alignment. And I think we can really move the needle, because if you think of the amount of influence, let's say, on the country that companies can have, the private sector is almost five times larger than the government sector. I think the government's roughly $4 trillion, and the private sector is over $18 trillion.
Wow.
So if we just move the needle just a little bit, the potential for good is enormous.
I'm wondering about the metrics that Just Capital is relying on here and how subjective some of those are. For instance, I mean, treatment of employees. Mm-hmm. How do you measure something like that?
Well, we use a lot. There's an awful lot of information available, like in SEC filings. There's a lot of information available for companies with respect to their human resource policies. Then you might go to other sources of information like Glassdoor. So there's a variety of data sources that are used. For customers and customer treatment, J.D. Power is sharing their data and their information. The American Customer Satisfaction Index is sharing their rich data in this area to come up with those rankings. So what we're doing at Just is going out and getting the best data that's available. It's not perfect. But it's the best job that we can do, and it'll get better each year.
Who started Just Capital? Because it started back in 2013, I think. Who got it going?
Paul Tudor Jones was a very successful investor, and he believed that capitalism could be a force for good, and a greater force for good, for the reasons that I've described. And so he really got the ball rolling and put in the key seed funding. And it is, publicly supported because it is a nonprofit, but he's really the visionary behind it.
You know, some people listening to this might wonder about the philosophy here, because a lot of folks think it's the shareholder, the stockholder, who's king of the jungle here. And don't stockholders want to maximize return on investment no matter what?
Well, this is...
It all sounds good until I look at my quarterly report.
But what the other thing that we found is that Just companies have a return on equity 50% higher over the last 5 years than the rest of the list, if you will.
Why is that?
My personal view is that by treating their employees well and treating their customers well, what you see in these Just companies are really strong cultures, and which really build the brand over the long term. And when I say over 5 years, there's a lot of fluctuation in the stock market, but if you look at long term, those companies with really strong brands and your culture, if you will, is your almost human representation of the company's brand. The brand, you take a very holistic view of the brand. And so you take a look at the culture. So we're looking at, okay, what makes these companies so successful? Because what we're trying to also do to change behavior is create what we call a roadmap for corporate America. These companies that are really at the top of the list, how can we affect change by showing the other companies what it takes to become just?
Mm-hmm.
And we find these really strong, if you will, employee-centric and customer-centric cultures in these companies. And it's a virtuous cycle.
Mm-hmm.
Happy employees treat customers really well, and when customers are happy, they feel better about their company and what have you.
We're going to go to the list in just a moment, but I couldn't help but notice, I know you've been asked this before, that a lot of the companies toward the top of the list are these incredibly successful, lucrative software companies.
Mm-hmm.
And it made me think, not every company is that successful, and is the list skewed by the fact that these companies are at the top of the heap because they're in the high tech world and that world's doing so well these days?
Yeah, I think there could be something to that, but I think there's also something about being in those industries that have forced those companies to be so good, because you're competing for the same talent, for example. For example, chip companies, a lot of them near the top of the list, and
right,
software companies. They know what it takes to compete for the best talent. You got to treat your people really well. You got to pay them well. You got to have a culture that people want to work for. And I think that competition has caused certain industries, competition among themselves, to rise to the top.
That's interesting. And to your point, Ann tweeted this: I agree with your guest. I shop at Costco instead of Sam's Club, even though there is a Sam's Club 5 minutes from my house, because Costco treats its people even better.
That's a great example. And can you imagine? And so I think, I would encourage people just to go to the Just Capital website. It's just justcapital.com, because you not only can see the rankings overall, and they're based upon, if you will, these weightings. But if something's more important to you, like how they treat their people, or their environmental footprint. You can slice and dice it, if you will. You can look at which companies, you can do it by industry. You can slice it in many, many different ways to help you with your purchase decisions. But your the woman that tweeted in, she knew about Costco's, for example, you know, how they pay their employees.
Right.
Imagine if there was just a lot more of this information out there, easy to get. We do believe it would shape buyer behavior. And then you would see, if you will, better alignment between shareholder interests and the interests of, we'll call it, the country mm-hmm. in general.
Well, let's break the suspense here. Which company came out number one on the Just Capital list of the 1,000 biggest companies?
Intel came out number one.
Intel, okay. Yeah. Hey, how is working at Intel, do you think, Dan, different than working at a company that's not on this list?
Well, you know, I know Brian, and I won't even try to pronounce his last name. It starts with a K. It's one of these Slavic names that's very difficult to pronounce. You know, he described what they do at Intel. And first of all, they have a very employee-focused culture. And one of the examples of what they did, so if they're a Silicon Valley company, and there's been a lot of talk about, you know, how difficult it is to move, to have women populate the C-suite and to get good gender balance in Silicon mm-hmm. Valley and what mm-hmm. have you. And they decided to treat it just like any other corporate objective, that they were going to have a representative workforce. And they just went out and did it and measured it. And they, for example, they have the diversity inside the company reflects the diversity of their customer base, and they just went and did it. They measured it just like profit, just like any other thing.
Wow.
And so that's a good example of what Intel did to get to the number one position.
We're visiting with Dan Hesse, the former Sprint CEO, about Just Capital, a company that looks at and ranks companies based on how well they treat employees, customers, and a whole lot more. Nike's in 14th position, Dan. Pepsi, 19th. Eli Lilly, 28th. Garmin's at 41st. Apple came in at 34. Should I be surprised it isn't higher?
Are you talking about Apple?
Apple, yeah.
You know, I actually haven't gone into Apple's results, you know, by category to see why they didn't come out higher. You know, one thing you can say for Apple is, you know, just, you know, they're known for high quality products, but they are also very, you know, they've been a company very, very focused on the shareholders. Mm-hmm. Not that that's a bad thing, but I'd have to go in and look at the data. But by the way, to be on the Fortune 100, I mean, be on the Just 100 list, that's an accomplishment.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, being in the 30s, if you're, you know, it's 1,000 companies, you know, Apple did pretty well, mm-hmm. if you will, to be in the top 40 out of over 900 companies.
I've got to ask, where did Sprint show up here?
I think they're actually just missed the Just 100. They're mm-hmm. in the, maybe 120, 115, someplace like that. So pretty respectable showing.
What do you think what impact have your most Just companies list had? Do you have any feedback or any real solid sense of that yet?
The team in New York might be getting more of that. You know, the results were just recently released, and so it takes some time, anecdotally an awful lot mm-hmm. of, and we've seen, one of the ways we see it is in corporate interest. Companies, based upon their ranking, coming in, asking questions, getting involved, that's really the behavior that we want to see, because that's really what this is all about, is changing company behavior. And there's just been a lot of connection, a lot of communication between the companies that Just is ranking and the team at Just Capital in New York.
Does Just Capital invest in any of these companies? Is there an active investment fund going on?
Actually, Goldman Sachs. So we don't, because in Just we just want to be Switzerland. You know, mm-hmm. we provide the data, but Goldman Sachs just filed with the SEC for an ETF, which is like a tracking fund, where you can go invest in this fund, and the fund invests in the best performers on the Just list.
No kidding.
Yes.
And you'd recommend that, perhaps, because you're pointing out that these companies tend to do better.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, as I mentioned, a significantly better return on equity. Mm-hmm. And I would expect that to continue.
Does anyone else compile a list like this, or is this something new in the marketplace?
I believe it's new. Nothing this comprehensive has been done. So, actually, I was asked a similar question by, you know, Jim Cramer on CNBC, and like comparing it to Glassdoor. Mm-hmm. And so Glassdoor looks at one area, which is how employees are treated.
Yeah.
This is very comprehensive in terms of overall justness, and employees are one of many constituents. So we just saw this as a need that wasn't being met, and that's why we've gone out and done this.
Yeah, I got to just add here that being interviewed by Jim Cramer is a little bit different than being interviewed by me, right? He's a force of nature.
Yeah,
isn't he?
I think he's a little more caffeinated.
Yeah, absolutely. That's Dan Hesse from Just Capital. The list is available. Just Google around for Just Capital, and you'll come right across the list. And Dan, it's always great to have you here. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Now from the Kansas News Service, it's time for State House Blend Kansas with Jim McLean.
How important is the tone a governor sets in state politics? Can a tenor of optimism or the opposite affect policy? And what in the age of Trump are Kansas voters wanting from their next governor? Those are just some of the questions we're asking on this edition of State House Blend Kansas, as we discuss the transition from former Governor Sam Brownback to new governor Jeff Collier. I'm Jim McLean, and this is State House Blend, Kansas. Joining me at the top of the podcast is Kansas Public Radio State House Bureau Chief Stephen Caranda. Hello again, Stephen.
Hello.
Okay, it's no secret about the top story this week. Hands down, it's got to be Lieutenant Governor Jeff Collier's ascension to, if not the throne, at least the best office in the State House. And I'd like to chat with you about what practical difference this change in leadership will make. Is Jeff Collier a Sam Brownback clone, as Kansas Democrats are charging, or is he a guy who just can't wait to show people just how different he really is from his predecessor? What say you?
Well, I think it's a little too early to know on the policy side exactly what we're going to see, because he's been planning on rolling out things here in the coming weeks. We're expecting more budget proposal ideas. We're expecting kind of maybe executive orders on transparency issues. He's also talked about fighting sexual harassment, but we kind of have to see how they materialize.
There was one thing I think that was pretty tangible in the sense that literally the morning after he was inaugurated, Collier scheduled some meetings with legislative leaders, and of course he met with Republican leaders, to be expected, because Collier, of course, is a Republican. But he also scheduled a meeting with Democratic leaders, and he talked a bit about that when we got together with him.
I asked them about their ideas on things like school finance. They asked me ideas as well. I thought that was a good first start. Certainly no agreement. I mean, these are massive decisions. We're going to keep that dialogue open. We're going to keep working with people.
So how about that, Stephen? He met with Democrats, only 30 minutes, but clearly it was an olive branch, right?
Yeah, I mean, it seems to be that he's reaching out to them. That was one of the kind of the criticisms we had heard from Democrats.
In fact, we have Anthony Hensley talking just about that point specifically.
I didn't have many opportunities, really, to sit down with Governor Brownback and try to negotiate issues, because he felt like he really didn't need the Democrats. And so I'm hopeful that Governor Collier will change that, and he'll be more inclusive.
Hensley's not the only one who says that. The minority leader in the House, Jim Ward, told me he had a meeting with Brownback right before he left, and it was only the second time he'd had a meeting like that. So that is definitely kind of a change we're seeing, but how that's going to play out into policy is unclear, because if we end up with K-12 funding plans that Democrats don't like, we could be getting back to things where it's Republicans really trying to hold their own together to pass what they want.
I think it can be accurately said that we're in a honeymoon period now, so really time will tell. I know it's a cliche, but it's also true. Okay, a lot happening next week, I know, and I look forward to talking to you next week about all of that, Stephen. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Lots of leaders have governed with a sense of optimism, even in dire times. Several come to mind, including Ronald Reagan. You can hear it in the now famous political commercial that helped propel him to a landslide victory and a second term in 1984.
It's morning again in America. And under the leadership of President Reagan, our country is prouder and stronger and better. Why would we ever want to return to where we were less than four short years ago?
Okay, so we take this brief trip down memory lane to lead us into a discussion about Kansas, specifically the contrasting styles of two of the leading Republican candidates for governor. We have Jeff Collier and his New Day in Kansas approach, and how that contrasts with his conservative rival, Secretary of State Chris Kobach, who seems to have a more Trump-like focus on immigration and what he asserts is runaway corruption in Topeka. For some perspective, we turn to Bob Beatty, a political scientist at Washburn University. He was in the rotunda the other day to listen to Governor Collier's inaugural speech.
And when we talked the other day, immediately after the speech, you were struck by the threat of optimism all the way through the speech. And that probably, I think your analysis and your conclusion is that wasn't by accident. He is positioning himself in the upcoming race for governor as kind of that classic Republican optimist in the mold of what, say, former President Reagan?
From what I've noticed with Governor Collier over the last year or so, and with his gubernatorial announcement, that rather than mention Governor Brownback, he mentions Ronald Reagan all the time.
And the fact that he was a White House fellow.
Yes, and that fits in. And so this is a conscious strategy and of embracing Ronald Reagan. And part of that embracing Ronald Reagan is that optimism that Reagan had, which I would argue is probably also a contrast with Chris Kobach.
Well, yeah, I was going to go there next. It does put him in stark contrast with Kobach, who seems to be more in the mold of a Donald Trump in terms of he's talking about corruption in government, and it's kind of analogous to drain the swamp, and essentially saying that the place is a mess and only I can fix it, in much the same way that President Trump campaigned.
Kobach has attached himself to Donald Trump. He had an event with Trump's son. He raises the specter of illegal voting, you know, in the ways that Trump does, and talked about corruption in Topeka. Well, if Kobach's talking about corruption in Topeka, you know, he's talking about Jeff Collier. Because who ran the show for the last 7 years, Brownback and Collier?
Well, let's let people listen to this contrast. Let's listen to a little bit of what Chris Kobach had to say the day he announced his candidacy for governor, and then also hear a little bit from Jeff Collier from his inaugural speech of the other day.
I just want to talk about three things, three problems that illustrate how bad it is in Topeka: corruption, taxation, and illegal immigration. First, corruption. It seems like the legislators just waste their time every year until they get to the end, and then at the end of the legislative session, they jam everything into a couple of weeks, and they pass some of the worst legislation we've ever seen.
Now, there are some who say Kansas is in an unwinnable situation, that everything is broken. Yes, it is challenging. It has always been challenging in Kansas. But the great secret of the Kansas soul is that we believe in service, and we believe in each other. It's time for a new tone that reflects the best of our state.
So we do have these contrasting styles. And for a long time, Bob, people have thought Chris Kobach, the front runner in that race, simply because his name recognition is so high. I mean, he's known all over the country and certainly known here in Kansas, but he's infamous in some circles. But the thought was that he had this really conservative constituency pretty much locked up in the state. But you see Collier as a real threat to Kobach in the primary, even though they may be after the same conservative wing of the party?
Well, we have no polls. I'm sure the candidates have polls, and that's probably, to be honest, informing Collier's approach. But a lot of people, and I've seen it in print, label Kobach the front runner, and just from an analytical point of view, I disagree. I think Collier's the front runner. I think that the Kansas Republicans are a relatively conservative bunch, and that's conservative in demeanor, not policy. And Collier's a much safer choice, especially if he's saying, you know what, I'm going to basically keep 90% of Brownback's policies, but I can sell the optimism that he couldn't, and I'm willing to work with people and there won't be so much fighting. That's probably pretty appealing to Kansas Republicans, whereas Kobach, it's a wild card. I mean, it would be exciting.
Much like Trump.
It'd be controversial. Exactly like Trump. And Do I see Kansas Republicans taking that leap? I don't. Some people argue that they would.
Well, some people would argue they already have because we voted overwhelmingly for Trump in Kansas.
Well, that was versus Hillary Clinton.
Right.
So, it's just one person's opinion. I think Collier's—
But an informed opinion. That's why we're talking to you.
Yeah, very good shape. And he's not just, he's not taking this approach on a whim. Collier has thought it out, and I think he feels the winning strategy is to offer himself as going down, keeping the same policies as Brownback, but a different package, and offering himself as an alternative to Kris Kobach. In that sense, if Collier comes out of the primary as the winner, you know, he's probably going to be looking better than if Kobach had not been there.
Well, we've got the next several months to see how much Collier is really going to change things up, how he's going to demonstrate that he's not, as Kansas Democrats are claiming, a Brownback clone. You can be sure we'll follow all the twists and turns of the campaign and the legislative session here on State House Blend. So from the offices of the Kansas News Service, I'm Jim McLean. We'll see you next week.
You can hear the entire episode of State House Blend Kansas at kcur.org. And don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, or wherever you get your podcasts. Miss former Obama Press Secretary Josh Earnest offering his thoughts on the current administration's dealing with the media. You can find that and our other conversations in podcast form. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. You can find us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. Tomorrow, the life of Laura Ingalls Wilder beyond the Little House on the Prairie and why some sports teams are rethinking their use of Native American imagery. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Claire Verbeck. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.